everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Weems Byers. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. So today we're discussing the whole concept of impoundment of funds by the president and what is allowed to be halted and what is not. We'll talk about statutes that outline what powers the president has and what powers rest with Congress. We'll also discuss some of the recent court cases concerning President Trump's executive orders. So let's start out, and let me just sort of set the stage here by saying that the Trump administration is setting up a constitutional collision course by impounding a lot of funds that Congress has appropriated for programs both domestically and foreign aid type programs. So the question that this president is setting up, which will probably ultimately be resolved by the Supreme Court, is does the president have the power to halt, delay, or not spend money that Congress has appropriated? So, just as a brief constitutional primer, Congress is given specific powers of the purse through Article 1, Section 9, Clause, Article 1, Section 9, it says, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. No money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law. Okay, Judge Gill, what the hell does that mean?
So what it essentially means is if you're anything like me and you grew up learning about the three separate co-equal branches of government through Schoolhouse Rocky, and as he taught us about what it means to be a bill sitting on Capitol Hill, what essentially you've learned is that the power to design budgets or to expend monies or to appropriate monies rests with one of those three branches of government. There's the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. The legislative branch is vested with the authority to appropriate money. And once Congress appropriates or gives the money, which is what the power of the purse is, because they're also the branch that makes the laws, once they appropriate the monies, it is the responsibility of the executive branch to do what? To execute. Hence, executive, and to execute on essentially those instructions that have been set out by Congress. And so
pay it out in accordance with the law, right?
In accordance with the law, just as you've just described that particular article of the Constitution that says, hey, we determine who gets the money. You all are responsible for making sure that it is appropriated that way, or it is actually expended that way. And an impoundment, when there is an impoundment, then that means that there is a delay or an effort to permanently cancel the funding after it's already been enacted by Congress. And that is kind of where we find ourselves with regard to a lot of the pending lawsuits as of late that have been born out of and from actions taken by the executive branch. When it appears at least the executive branch has unilaterally or on its own, without Congress's knowledge or input or permission, has decided on its own that it would seek to either permanently delay or actually write out full-flown cancel federal funding after it's already been enacted and approved through the legislative branch, which is where the Constitution anticipates or has always indicated that these funding decisions would come from. Now, that is what an impoundment is. That's what it means to impound funds, and in view of many, to do so illegally. Well, the framers of the Constitution always, you know, kind of anticipated that this might happen again, where you have a new government that's new and you've got these separate branches, which is exactly why it imposed these triggers and these guardrails that it had. But if you reach back even 50 or so years ago, back to 1974, Congress passed the Impoundment Control Act of 1974, or the ICA. And this actually gave us a legal mechanism for the president to legally seek to delay or to cancel those federal funds that had been enacted by Congress, as opposed to just doing it unilaterally without congressional input or approval. And the ICA is really clear about how this process should go, this process of impounding. So it should be understood that impounding in and of itself is not the illegality. It is how that process is undertaken that triggers the illegality and perhaps even some of the problems that we're experiencing or have given rise to lawsuits today.
Let me jump in here, and because the ICA, as you mentioned, that was passed in 1974, the Impoundment Control Act. I love that title. Impoundment Control Act is the only mechanism in existence today for the president to delay or withhold funds.
Absolutely.
But the president cannot cancel funds. And that's part of the rub in now with the executive orders. But before the president can do that, even under the ICA, the Impoundment Control Act, the president must notify Congress of his intention before delaying or withholding funds. It's called a special message to Congress.
I was going to say those are called special messages.
And that was not done in this particular case. Trump did not file any special messages with Congress before he started issuing his executive orders.
And I don't think any have been filed since. I am not certain if the executive branch, well, I would suspect that they are familiar with the Impoundment Control Act of 1974, but I don't know that there's a lot of regard for the ICA of 1974 because were it. And mind you, I don't know that there historically has been a lot of pushback to a president who sent special messages. Now, these are not used frequently, but they have been used, and they've been used with, you know, enough experience in the past to help guide us even through kind of rocky waters that we're in right now.
But I can give you numbers. I've got numbers.
How did I know you would have them?
From 1975 until 1985, 75 to 85, that decade, 156 special messages were sent to Congress.
Okay.
Between 85 and 2002, only 83 special messages were sent to Congress. Now, let's move forward. 2002 through 2017, there were no special messages sent to Congress. In 2018, President Trump sent 3 special messages to Congress. President Biden sent only 1 special message, withdrawing a previous special message sent by President Trump. So
a cancellation.
So they've been used less and less over the years, these special messages.
It looks like a total of what, less than 300 times, 250 times or so, with them
since 1970, since the Control Act went into effect.
I was going to say, with most of them being right after the legislation was passed in 1975, which was the year after, it looks like the most activity we saw from an administration was right after that and lasting about a decade.
75 to 85, 156.
Yes. And it's tapered off considerably. And so I guess that now goes back to the point I was making before you outlined those very important statistics as to this administration, because what we now know, when you indicated that back in 2018, the first Trump administration sent three special messages regarding impoundment, it means this administration does know about its requirement to comply with the ICA and has perhaps deliberately or purposely or intentionally, I don't know, because if you've done it before, you clearly know that this is the correct mechanism. So you are purposely disregarding the law in so doing. And the way that this works best, and I think that what we hear is a lot of consternation from just everyday average folks, like, how does this happen? How can someone do this? Why does this happen? It also requires that Congress not abdicate its authority as well under the ICA. And this is designed to ensure that there are these checks and balances. Again, as you said, the Impoundment Control Act requires that the president, in so doing, provide a justification for why this is happening before it happens and not seek to do so after it happens.
Well, the special message, Judge Gale, has to contain the reason for the impoundment, along with an estimate of the physical, economic, and budgetary impacts of the impoundment. So all of those are necessary to go to Congress before the impoundment. None of that has happened.
It sounds like it's an analysis, right? It sounds like what it requires is a really good explanation or reason as to why there should not be follow through on this particular appropriation from Congress with what you've just described, which is not just a reason for the action, but, and also it also requires that you identify the types of funds being withheld.
It's sort of like a victim impact statement that we used to have in court on criminal cases. You know, what impact does this action take? You know, what impact does it have on real folks?
And the truth is, it's not designed to completely excise out or to get rid of or to refuse to follow through on those appropriations. It is a delay or withholding, but it's not designed, as you said, to be a complete cancellation. So it's not that the presidency is invested with the authority to just decide that no, you know, certain government agencies are just not going to get the money at all. They may be delayed in doing so. And even with that delay, the executive branch is responsible for providing Congress with a really thorough analysis of what the impact of that delay is going to do. So if we, you know, take USAID, for example, and the fact that Congress had appropriated billions of dollars to USAID, it is not that the executive branch could not have sent a special message to Congress and said to Congress, it is our intent to withhold the payment of these funds, and we're going to specifically withhold them for this action or this reason. These are the exact funds that are going to be withheld. This is the reason why. And here's the impact that withholding these funds will cause. I think that those are things, especially given, you know, from a political and jockeying standpoint, that there's, you know, the prevailing party, the president's party, is also in the majority in both chambers of Congress, I think there may have very well been some positive reception to a special message. But there was no such message that was provided, as you indicated, Judge. No such message was provided to Congress, either before, during, or after. In fact, I don't know that there's been any reporting that the administration has provided even a special message after the fact, much less before the fact.
None. And let me point out also that the U.S. Government Accountability Office, the U.S. Government Accountability Office, is responsible for reviewing all special messages to ensure that they comply with legal requirements.
Yes.
We also, this is their statement, we also investigate and report to Congress when the president withholds funds without sending a special message, and we provide informal assistance and formal legal decisions on impoundment issues at the request of members of Congress and agency officials. Well, one, there have been no special messages for them to review, and two, Congress, given its current partisan makeup, isn't going to ask them for any help. So it not only circumvents the statute, what's been done, but it circumvents a procedure within government for another check and balance.
I do agree, except that I'll say this. I think that certainly there can be requests from parties or from congressional members who are not part of the majority in either chamber in Congress.
Yeah, so but it's not been done.
Their role isn't limited to just, you know, only those in control can ask the GAO or the Government Accountability Office for an opinion or for assistance. Anyone that's a member of Congress can do so. And you're right. I'm not aware that any member of Congress has raised this as an issue and indicated that the GAO is responsible for providing assistance to not only investigate and to report to Congress when funds are withheld without a special message, which is exactly what this is, right? So even if, at least it appears to me, even if a member of Congress does not specifically ask the GAO to investigate or to proceed in their statutory authority, it at least appears that the GAO automatically has, is the trigger in the law. They automatically have a responsibility to investigate and also to report to Congress when these funds are being withheld without the issuance of the special message, which is exactly what we've just said, is that, hey, there clearly is indicia that the executive branch is withholding funds. There's clear evidence that this is happening, which is also buttressed by the several lawsuits that have been filed. And in addition to that, we already know that the ICA of 1974, which has been the law of the land, has been followed by administrations on both sides. And they have adhered to this law that is clearly being ignored right now. And it at least appears to me, Judge, and you let me know what you think, it appears to me by the very statutory language that the GAO automatically has a responsibility to begin and initiate this, an investigation of its own, and to provide a report to Congress because the withholding has taken place without the special messages being sent to Congress. And it allows Congress, it actually, I would think, put them on notice and to provide them the insight they otherwise could have sought directly, but it puts them on notice and then allows Congress to decide how they want to proceed. Now, with all of that said, my concern is for the GAO itself, right? So if the executive has any authority over appointing who's at the GAO and who heads the GAO and who's responsible at the GAO, then will the GAO respond to the natural trigger in the law that says you don't have to wait for Congress to ask you to investigate? You actually should do it on your own. You're required to do it on your own when you know that there are withholdings that have taken place minus the special message that's required under the Act.
Let me add to that. Right now, the Office of Management and Budget, the director that was appointed by President Trump is a loyalist and is a leading proponent of Trump ignoring spending laws and blocking investments.
And I just want to say this to our listeners, the OMB, the Office of Management and Government, think of it as like the federal government's HR department.
Yeah, Office of Management and Budget, you're right. And Trump also picked a gentleman to serve as OMB's general counsel, who has called the Impoundment Control Act a stupid law, quote, and urged the director to impound, baby, impound. That's his quote. Impound, baby, impound. It sort of leaves you breathless, doesn't it?
It really does, because it also just kind of underpins how the all the levers that require all of these things to continue to work and to work well can be manipulated and controlled in a way that actually neuters them, quite frankly, and makes them less effective. And again, these are, I think, all things that maybe the framers did not anticipate, right? The framers did not anticipate that a president would come in and use the authority of the office to, you know, to essentially gut, to neuter, to control every single lever that could possibly act as a control feature or a check or balance on the administration. Now, again, the one thing that cannot be controlled is the fact that there's three separate co-equal branches of government. And you're absolutely right. Even if you have general counsel over at OMB, Office of Management and Budget, saying, yeah, just ignore that Impoundment Control Act. We know
impound, baby, impound.
And we know that we've complied with it before, which I think, and tell me what you think. I think it becomes really difficult for the administration, this current administration, to feign ignorance of the law or to not know or understand when they have clearly complied before.
They're not even feigning ignorance of the law. Stumbling over my own words here. They're not feigning ignorance of the law. They're saying, we know what the law is. We think the law is wrong. We're trying to change it. Now, the act was enacted in 1974. In 1975, in a case called the Train versus City of New York, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously upheld the law, saying presidents unilaterally cannot withhold or block funding appropriated by Congress. This administration is trying to set up a series of test cases to get back to the U.S. Supreme Court, saying that these laws are stupid. All of the power should be vested in the president and not in Congress. Congress can pass a budget, yeah, but it's really up to the president how he wants to spend that money to advance his political ideology.
I absolutely agree that I think that's the mindset of this current administration. And I think it even goes a step further to say, well, we'll only comply with court orders we agree with. If there is an order that we don't like, and no matter what court it comes from, we may give lip service to the idea that, yes, we will comply with orders from that third branch of government. But part of the incentive and the reason to try to steer most every case and decision, if you notice, given all that's happening, everything seems to be pointing toward the Supreme Court with the assumption that certiorari will be granted to all of them. But everything seems to be pointed there because I genuinely believe there is a belief from this administration that, well, we've got the court in the bag. We've, You know, most of those justices are justices that were appointed during the first administration. And so we should be pretty comfortable that we've got a solid majority in anything we want to do, even if it means slapping the judiciary in the face, even if it means essentially telling them we will only abide by the rulings that we think should apply to us, and anything that doesn't, then we're not really interested in following that. I think that's exactly kind of the posture that we're seeing, which is exactly why, as you said, I think there's an effort to steer the impoundment argument back to the U.S. Supreme Court, so that, you know, with there's the hope that they will get a ruling that is consistent with the general counsel from OMB that says that, you know, they think this is a stupid law and they don't have to comply. And what they just need is that their justices in their back pockets, which, by the way, is so insulting and so offensive. But essentially, the justices are in their back pockets and all they need is the ruling from the highest court in the land to say so, and all's well. I wonder how these same folks respond when they don't get the answer that they like.
They look back and they look at the 5-4 decision that came out July 1, giving presidential immunity, absolute immunity for any acts taken by the president that may be criminal under his official acts, and then presumptive immunity on other acts. You know, that was a 6-3 decision. Mm-hmm. By the court, with Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Alito, and Thomas, added Amy Coney Barrett and the Chief Justice, Justice John Roberts, in the majority. So the administration is looking at that 6 majority. Interesting, the president's speech the other day on the hot mic, afterwards, was picked up, the president thanking Chief Justice Roberts, saying, thank you very much, and I won't forget it. so that does not bode well. However,
do you think, and I'll get to your however in a second, do you think John Roberts feels some kind of way about that, and that has that casts some kind of aspersion on him as a jurist and as someone who's the face of the judiciary?
I think he's lost control of the court and he's looking at his legacy and he's going, how can I get this back? Mm. How can I make this court again have the trust of the American public, which it does not have now? And so I think on even minor rulings recently, we've seen 5-4 decisions against Trump with Chief Justice Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett going with the 3 liberal members of the court. And so they are the 2 swing votes that will make the difference in whether or not Trump is successful with consolidating power in the executive.
Do you think that the justices are experiencing a little bit of heartburn and buyer's remorse after the immunity decision? I would like
no
to
for
think
Alito,
that
that's... no for Thomas, no for Kavanaugh, no for Gorsuch. No, definitely. Well, you know, it basically in a dissent recently, Alito just said the majority decision in which Coney Barrett and Chief Justice joined, he just said it was stupid and that they will regret the day that they did it. You know, so we certainly don't have the civility on the court that we once had.
No, I mean, it was a time when justices would be really, really careful about the language that they use when, when dissenting. I mean,
right. Probably the justice that changed that was Justice Scalia. He was a little sort of acerbic in some of his dissents.
But he
counteracted that by being a teddy bear. I mean, he and Justice Ginsburg were best friends. On a personal level, he was just an adorable kind of guy. In his legal verbiage, he could be quite acerbic. But, that's not the case now. Now everything is personal. Everything is personal.
Indeed it is. And I would think sometimes it's a little difficult to separate one from the other, right? When you have that close working relationship with folks, and at the end of the day, you still understand their ideology is so far removed from your own. And yet, the justices figure out how to still maintain, would or used to figure out how to still maintain very civilized and often close-knit relationships. I don't know that that's the case anymore.
That's not the case anymore. When I was there, and I was I worked in the administrative office of the Chief Justice the first year of Chief Justice William Rehnquist's time as Chief Justice, the court was pretty divided. You had Thurgood Marshall on the court, a very big liberal. You had William Brennan on the court that was a big liberal. You had Sandra Day O'Connor, and you had a real variety of people on the court. But yet Chief Justice Rehnquist, one of the most conservative people that you'd ever come across from legal scholarship point of view, was best friends with Justice Brennan, who was the biggest liberal on the court. Wow. They played poker every Tuesday night together. They had relationships that allowed them to have differences. But now the differences are front and center so that it prohibits relationships.
And you're right. And I don't know, but I tend to think that the media has done its job in kind of highlighting them such that some of these, the ability to build these relationships become all the more difficult, because in the event that the media reports a cozying up, if you will, or a civilized work environment at the Supreme Court, then one side or the other is going to scream bloody murder, because no doubt they immediately believe that those personal relationships will impact how they view or how they think or how they will decide cases that come before it. What role do you think the media has played in maybe, helping to kind of taint the well a little bit here?
Well, I think the media has always struggled in covering the Supreme Court, because in the past, the Supreme Court has been so secretive. And so justices rarely gave interviews. So the media really had to focus on the cases before the court. That was the main function of the media when I was there and throughout most of my legal career. They focused on the cases before the court. Now, the media is focused on the personalities of the court. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't blame media totally for that, because the court has allowed them to do that by not having an enforceable code of ethics.
Indeed.
By having all of these financial issues with gifts and trips and people appearing before the court that has have relationships with justices. The court has opened the door for the media to make this now a personality court as opposed to a judicial philosophy court.
I absolutely agree to what you just said. It is in large part the court's own making, and the fact that where remedies could have been introduced and implemented, that they have not done nearly as much as they should have. Even the small, efforts that Justice Roberts has at least leaned into as of late, I think it still falls woefully short of what the court should be doing, particularly on the issue of ethics and
absolutely,
and everything else, and that he's just not, and he's failed not just the court and the judiciary, but by extension, he's failed the American people who rely on this court to be an independent branch of government. And in fact, his lack of action on the court, I think, has led to a trickle-down effect such that it impacts the judiciary nationwide. It impacts how judges are perceived in any town, USA.
I agree.
Affects this, you know, you have federal judges now who are following the law and making rulings based on the law. They're well-reasoned, they're well-analyzed, they are well-vetted, and yet there's still impeachment articles being introduced against federal judges, all because, again, you know, you have an executive who believes in a consolidation of power, but you also have a judiciary who the face of that judiciary has not done enough to kind of insulate the courts from this type of rampant foolishness.
That's one of my major criticisms with Chief Justice Roberts, allowing the court to be a personality center, allowing the court to be questionable on matters of ethics has opened the door to media criticism and public criticism. Then you add that to the fact that they issued decision so out of line with precedent on the presidential immunity thing, mm-hmm. showing that they were handing power to Trump. And giving him almost unbridled authority to do whatever he wanted. Those two things have combined to diminish the court. Whether the court can get that back, whether Justice Coney Barrett and Chief Justice Roberts will be the swing votes to try to get that back. Justice Roberts used to be known as an institutionalist, the court above all. Well, he's given up that right. He mm-hmm. can try to reclaim it. But I think those are the two that are going to be targeted in any future legal arguments. Hey, I've got a question for you on this. Because if we go back to the Impoundment Control Act, of 1974, which is where we started this discussion. It talks about the president delaying and sending special messages to Congress. But it also contains language that I'm not sure most people have seen, but I did some research and checked this out. It also says that the president may not withhold Social Security
and
or Medicare funding. Mm-hmm. So by all stretches of what he's done, if past is prologue, you know, what he's done in the first month and a half to 2 months, looks like he doesn't care about this Impoundment Control Act. Will he care about it when it comes to Social Security and Medicare? And if he goes that route to cut off Social Security and Medicare payments, or if Musk does that, will that be a step too far for the Supreme Court? If you were advising the president and said, you know, you can push it, but if you push that, you're over the line. You're going to get smacked.
Well, let's be clear. I don't know that this is the kind of president that would take advice from anyone, much less me. And I certainly would have advised to never have done all that has been done so far. I would have advised to follow the law. And whereas the law is very clear, even when your end goal does not at least appear to be popular with some, but it is part of your administrative it's your within your administrative purview, and this is what you desire to do, I would certainly have warned against all of this. But as it relates to Social Security and Medicaid, I genuinely...
Medicare, rather.
I apologize. Medicare, not Medicaid. Those are two different programs, folks. But what I would say is I genuinely think that, yes, the president will impound those funds. Well, actually, no, I'll take that back. He won't impound those funds. He's going to make sure those payments aren't made, but they're going to somehow become the fault of Mike Johnson and the House of Representatives.
Or the fact that they've gutted the Social Security Administration and there's nobody there to make the payments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which also, again, so we're back to, you know, the authority of the executive branch. And I do believe there was a ruling just a week or so ago that outlined that the Office of Management and Budget and the new Department of Government Efficiency have no authority to fire employees in other departments. That is not within their authority to do. Now, there's no point of having secretaries if you are going to essentially usurp their authority and fire all of their employees. And so I think the administration has finally, you know, accepted or fessed up to the fact that, you know, notwithstanding the face you sought to put on the Department of Government Efficiency, the face of it is really Mr. Musk. And in addition to that, OMB, working hand in hand with that department, has essentially gone through and cauterized a good portion of the federal workforce in contravention of the law, meaning this was all illegal. You had no authority to fire all of these people. If in fact these people, you did not want them there, then this is perhaps an assignment you should have given to your secretaries to have them analyze their own workforce and determine through retirements, attrition, layoffs, and anything else, how much of that workforce need or should be cut and what it should be scaled back to. But this was the absolute worst way to go about doing it, just like impoundment is the worst way to go about withholding public funds. But I think the reason why the administration and the president, they are not going to be held accountable for what happens with Social Security payments is because they're going to get Congress to essentially do their bidding. And they're going to do their bidding through their committee work and their budgetary work that's going to scale back and cut off so many Social Security benefits that the administration is going to say, well, it wasn't us. It was Congress this time. You told us to go through Congress, and we did, and this is what they came back with. So be mad at your member of Congress. And I promise you, this administration doesn't care which wheels on which tires run over which back of which member of Congress. They do not care.
Yeah,
they will stand by and let them get run over and watch it as it happens, as long as it doesn't happen to them.
Well, let's walk through a little bit about court cases on this, and I want our listeners to understand that when organizations or groups of people file cases against President Trump's executive orders, they're filing them in district courts around the country. Now, district courts are the trial court level of the federal judiciary. So we're getting trial judges appointed by all kinds, Republicans and Democrats alike, ruling on various aspects of what the president has done with executive orders. So that's the first line. Certainly it's not the end line, but it's the first line of judicial interpretation. And Judge Gale, a federal judge on March 6th, you know, very recent, extended an order that prevented the Trump administration from freezing billions of dollars in congressionally approved funds to 22 states and the District of Columbia. The judge found that the administration had overstepped in trying to stop the agencies from using money appropriated by Congress. So, I mean, this is exactly what we're talking about. This was Judge John McConnell Jr., mm-hmm. a federal district judge in the district of Rhode Island, right next to me. He said that what the president was doing was amounting to executive overreach. Yeah. So we've got, to your point earlier, we've got federal judges, but these are federal trial judges making these very important decisions, frontline decisions that are trying to stop the halt of some of this funding.
And you are absolutely right. I think the thing that you and I have discussed before, and it's just as true here, and it's equally disheartening because I genuinely believe that judges are really trying to make the best and most timely decisions with the information that they have, and that they too, the courts are getting, you know, slammed and they're having whiplash because things are constantly changing on a near daily basis. But you can't hear, read, or research any decision that a court or judge has made as of late without also reading, hearing, or seeing right after their name a comma and followed by whomever the president is that appointed them or nominated them. Because in many instances, the idea is that the nominating president's ideology is one that is going to naturally be adopted by that judge. And so you can almost expect or anticipate what the outcome is going to be based on that correlation. I actually reject that. And I wish that John Roberts had done more to help guard the judiciary and protect the judiciary against kind of this rampant connectivity, because it's not always true. In fact, again, the decision that he and Justice Coney Barrett joined in with the other liberal judges on the court with regarding the U.S. aid package that was being impounded by the executive branch is a perfect example of why it should not be a foregone conclusion that whomever appoints the judge, the decision is kind of baked in already, or the decision about a particular matter is baked in. When you mentioned the judge in Rhode Island, I was so refreshed that you did not mention who appointed that judge, because it should not matter. And quite frankly, I think for many judges, it does not matter. What matters is following the law. But you're absolutely right in that this is a textbook example of what impoundment is and what it looks like and why it invites litigation.
It was in the New York Times story that I was citing, though.
I am confident that somebody has clearly identified it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But and I don't know that it has any relevance, except that, again, there's this constant tie and connectivity to the appointing president, I suspect, only to continue to kind of subliminally reinforce this idea that whomever nominates or appoints the judge, you can almost anticipate or guarantee what their ruling's going to be. And I'll tell you, Judge Chutkan in Washington, D.C. actually stunned, I would think she would have stunned a lot of liberals, if you will, because she actually sided with the government in one of the cases that was brought before her court related to the mass firing of federal workers. And she was not very quick to side with the plaintiffs in that case. Instead, she sided with the government. And if we are to believe that judges appointed by, you know, Democratic presidents or in a Democratic administration are always going to be liberal, then I think that, you know, if nothing else, she's proven that to be wrong. But then there are so many judges that have been appointed by, you know, during the Bush eras, Bush one and Bush two eras, and likewise, that they have also sided on the side of democracy. I think the judge who made the ruling in, I believe, Washington State on the very first case out of related to this administration about birthright citizenship was actually, I think it was a Trump appointee from the first administration. And that judge clearly indicated that, you know what, it's on its face, it's unconstitutional, it's invalid, it's blatantly unconstitutional, we cannot do this. And that's why I think that we kind of run the risk, and I do, again, I hold Chief Justice Roberts responsible for this, because he's just kowtowed to this administration so many times that it's just been detrimental to the judiciary. But I think that having district court judges, which is part of this pecking order and this mechanism, it's just like any place else. You start at the trial court. If you don't like the decision of the trial court, you appeal to the appeals court.
Well, let's go through that. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about district court orders, and they're very intelligently done. These are not frivolous people. These are scholarly folk that write these opinions, but they're reviewable. And either side, because these aren't criminal matters, either side that feels aggrieved by a decision has a right to at least one appeal. And that appeal in the federal system would go to a circuit court of appeals. A circuit is a combination of states, mm-hmm. a geographic area, and a three-judge panel would review what the district court judge did to determine whether it was appropriate and whether it was constitutional and whether the judge made any major errors. So that's reviewable by a three-judge panel. If they don't like the three-judge panel, they can ask the entire group of judges for that circuit to review the case, too. That's called en banc, right?
En banc review. Exactly.
I should leave my Latin to you.
No, but I was just going to mention, you know, requesting an en banc review. And also, it's designed, you know, not only in instances where you're correct, where the result from the three-judge panel may not be desirous of, you know, one party or another, but also consider the fact that you don't have the same three-judge panel sitting on all cases that come to that circuit. And so the purpose and the benefit of an en banc review is to prevent the likelihood of conflicting decisions out of the same court for same or similar issues. So if you have a three-judge panel that hears this particular case, and there's another one that comes down the pike that may be similar or have some similar issues or similarities, and yet a different three-judge panel sits on that one and issues an opinion that is starkly different from their colleagues from maybe a few weeks or a few months prior, then you may actually find yourself with competing decisions out of the same court, and the court needs to cure that. And the way to cure that is with an en banc review, meaning bringing all the judges on so that you can have, you know, essentially the judges speaking with one voice, even when there are dissenters. You can still have a single decision from the court that kind of solves or resolves the issue. And that doesn't mean it can't be appealed from there, but it does mean that provides for more consistent resolution. Not all cases are hurt that way, but I think some of these more important ones, I suspect you're going to see more en banc reviews than anything.
And then after that, the party who's still dissatisfied, either party, could ask the U.S. Supreme Court to take jurisdiction of the case and to resolve it. They can either ask based on a constitutional question, what's called certiorari, or let's say two circuits have conflicting decisions on a particular matter that's similar. The court can take that to resolve the conflicts. Now, the key on this, Judge Gale, is the court will not take every case that they're requested to take. They're just going to be too many of them working their way up through the system. The court's going to be selective and really cherry-picking the cases it wants to take. I think Trump is betting that the court will take this case based upon some of the statements of Alito and Thomas and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. I think Trump just clearly wants the Supreme Court to strike down the Impoundment Control Act, mm-hmm. and he's setting up every way to do that. I don't see any way that the court would not take that case. Would you agree?
I do think, well, certainly the rule or the bar for getting certiorari is a little lower than getting a favorable decision out of the court. But I think that the president likes his odds. He likes his odds with getting certiorari granted, and he likes his odds with getting a favorable outcome. Although he may be somewhat back on his heels given the USAID decision, which was interesting because it was an unsigned opinion and it didn't absolutely rebuke the administration. What it did is said, hey, you know, we're going to send it back to the trial court because we don't think the trial court was wrong, but they didn't set out a timeline for making these payments. And so the trial court must, you know, cure the schedule of making the payments. But I do think that, and again, this may be super hopeful on the sides of those of us who are, you know, deeply committed to a democracy, and hoping that we still have justices on the Supreme Court that understand the need to hold the line and to hold the administration accountable to its role in government, and not beyond that, the overreach that you speak about, Judge Tom, is what we in the law call ultra vires. So extending beyond your reach or extending beyond what you have the authority to do is exactly what the administration at least appears to be doing.
Go with that Latin again.
I have to have some kind of expertise given, you know, all that you bring to the table.
You got it. You got it.
But yeah. I really do think the president likes his odds. I think that he's a betting man, and he's betting on himself. He's betting on the fact that he has, at least in his view, you know, he stacked a Supreme Court, and in fact, he's gone as far as to call them his justices. And so when you take such a personal stake in this, then it kind of speaks to how you genuinely view the court. He does not view the highest court in the land. He does not view it as an independent, separate, co-equal branch of government as much as it is viewed as a back pocket ace, ace in your back pocket to pull out at any time you want to make sure you one up anyone else who dare come against you.
Well, I think he sees it as an extension of the executive.
I don't think he respects them enough to see them as an extension of the executive. I think he sees them as puppets.
That's a good point.
I genuinely do not. I think he just sees them as, those are my personal possessive pronoun. Those are my justices, and they will do what I want them to do, or they will do what I tell them to do. They are not independent of me. They do not make decisions independent of me. They do not think independent of me. They dare not cross me. They are in line and lockstep with me because I said so. Even if I'm wrong, I said so. And I believe that's genuinely how he views them, which is why he could say to, you know, Governor Mills in Maine, who, between he and the governor, they got into a back and forth in front of all of the governors over, you know,
yes,
Maine
she said,
potentially not, you know, not doing what he said with regard to transgender rights. And his response was he was going to withhold federal funds. She said, we'd see you in court. And his immediate response was, that should be an easy win. Yeah. Oh my gosh. And I don't know him to be a lawyer, but God.
I've got that one. This sounds so like Sopranos, you know?
Yeah.
It sounds
you better do it. And the words he used were, you better do it. You better do it, or you're not getting any money. Her response was, we're following the law. We'll see you in court. And his rebuttal was, well, that should be an easy win.
Easy
and
win.
By the way, you need to be thinking of what your life is going to look like after public service, because basically you're not going to be in politics long.
God.
Yeah. And so, no, I don't think he respects them at all. I do not think, even especially the majority, he does not respect them as great legal minds, as a co-equal branch of government, as, you know, those who are setting out the in interpreting the laws of our land. He does not see them as that at all. He sees them as nothing more than a puppet whose back he can slide his hand up, move their mouth, and tell them what to do.
Well, on that note, we're going to wrap this one up. We're out of time. This whole impoundment issue is not over, though, and we will be following it throughout. We're just at the district court level, so we'll keep you posted as things work their way to the Supremes. And that being said, Judge Gail, how do people find us? What do you want them to do with us?
We invite you to please check us out. Check out Next Witness, please. On first and foremost, check us out on NPR. You can find all of our podcast episodes on the NPR directory. We are so proud and happy to have this relationship and affiliation with National Public Radio, one of our most enduring public radio outlets that this nation has had, and is a true gem for unbiased, objective information and news. But you can also find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or anywhere else you get your favorite podcast. And we want to remind you, first of all, we hope that we are doing an excellent job in educating you about these systems and situations that are affecting our lives. We believe that you don't trust what you don't understand, and our hope is that we're improving your understanding. And so when you go to your favorite podcast platform, make sure you not only like us, but be sure to subscribe. Because when you subscribe, then you'll be one of the first to know when a new episode of Next Witness, Please has dropped, so that you can continue to follow our in-depth analysis.
And if you have questions or comments about our podcast, you can email them to us. You can do that at my email address, which is hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N. @ohio.edu. And if you have topics you'd like for us to cover in the future, please just shoot us an email and we'll add your topic to our list. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUV Public Media at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gail and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.